We're going to go ahead and get started, if you could all find your seats, please. So I'll be very brief. I want to, if we could all sit down, please. Welcome back, everyone. Could you please sit down? So our second panel will present is a presentation, or I'm realizing that this was written for me and I didn't read it before I got up here, but this panel considers policy initiatives within the context of mobility, community development, and community change in Chicago. So let me introduce the presenters and the discussants, and then I'll turn it over to them. First, we'll have Mary Patillo. She's a professor of sociology and African American studies and chair of the sociology department at Northwestern University. Jens Ludwig, who is the McCormick Foundation Professor of Social Service Administration, Law, and Public Policy at the University of Chicago, and he's also the director of the University of Chicago Crime Lab. Then David Greenberg, who joins us from New York. He's a research associate at Manpower Demonstration Research Corporation. Our discussants are Clarence Wood, who has served as president and CEO of the Jane Addams Whole House Association since 2000. Alexander Polikop, who's the director of the Public Housing Program and former executive director at Business and Professional People for the Public Interest. He also has a much longer legacy, which I think you'll get filled in on today. And Joel Bookman, director of programs for the Local Initiatives Support Corporation in Chicago. So we'll start with Mary.
Thank you very much, Virginia. And I understand that there are sound issues. So I don't know if we've tested it with this new system. How does it sound out there now? Sounds good. Okay. So I'm not talking too fast or anything like that. Okay. So thanks very much to Rob for inviting me, and especially to the discussants who have a big job in front of them, and I'm not going to make that much easier by doing the old trick of having sent one paper and presenting on something else. Not totally different, and I'll give you a peek on what I sent the discussants also. Because what I'm trying to do today is actually stuff two things into one talk. So what I'll be presenting today comes from my most recent book, Black on the Block, which is a study of North Kenwood, Oakland, which I'll talk about in a minute. And in the book, there are two chapters, kind of schizophrenic chapters, one called The Case for Public Housing in North Kenwood, Oakland, and one called The Case Against Public Housing in North Kenwood, Oakland. And so I sent to the discussants the chapter on the case against public housing in North Kenwood, Oakland, and I'm going to present today the case for public housing in North Kenwood, Oakland, with a little preview of the case against. So with that, let me just start. First, it's good to have a Chicago audience, not to have to really say where North Kenwood, Oakland is too much, but it's bounded by 35th Street on the north, 47th Street on the south, Cottage Grove on the west, Lake Michigan on the east, just north of the University of Chicago and north of South Kenwood, where Barack Obama lives. And I've been I studied North Kenwood, Oakland. I still live there. I've been a member of the Conservation Community Council, so it's been an ethnographic study, but also an historical study and a legal study. And some of you all, I see some familiar faces, some of you all might have heard bits and pieces of this before, but just last night at a community meeting, I was reminded about how important it is to repeat this history time and time again. I was at a community meeting where the CEO of the CHA was there and his whole team was there, and we were talking about public housing in North Kenwood, Oakland, and the new mixed income developments, and it was amazing how little the CHA authorities knew about the legal cases governing public housing in North Kenwood, Oakland, and what the consent, the various commitments were to the neighborhood. So it's really important to continue to give this history. So North Kenwood, Oakland, just to give you a sense, has been changing. This, you know, part of this panel is and community change has been changing. This is the demographic data from 1990 to 2000, and of course I imagine there'll be more changes as we go forward. And so it's been gentrifying, but it's been gentrifying mostly with middle and upper income African Americans. So basically, you see the median family income more than doubling, the percentage of families with income over $50,000 more than tripling, the home ownership rate going up, the home values going up, and the poverty rate declining. Just to give you a sense of some of the demographics going on there. But the history that I'll be telling really focuses around the lakefront properties, what had been called the lakefront properties and today are known as two different developments, Lake Park Crescent, which is the totally new development, and Lake Park Place, which was renovated part of this. This is Lake Park Place. The lakefront properties were built in the 1950s and then another addition in the 1960s. Here are some other photographs. This is from 1968, and you see part of the second addition to the lakefront properties there. And this is just before they were demolished in 1997 with some of the high rises behind some of the old buildings in the neighborhood. So in 1986, there were six buildings in the lakefront properties, and all six buildings were emptied and slated for renovation. And all the families were moved out, and the promise of renovation began a series of promises, which I'll talk about, which is part of the case for public housing, a series of promises made to roughly 800 families that lived in the sixth building. That's another photograph before they were demolished. So today, the agreement, the buildings were demolished in 1998, and the agreement today is for the Chicago Housing Authority to build 240 replacement units of public housing in North Kenwood, Oakland. 600 units were demolished, 240 to be rebuilt, 120 to be built in this particular site, the Lake Park Crescent, which is under construction right now. So the transformation of the lakefront properties began in 1986 with the residents' mass relocation and continues still today with the building of Lake Park Crescent and some units in Jazz on the Boulevard, also in the neighborhood. The long passage of time, I argue, is also a part of the story of community change because it leads to the kind of collective amnesia that I just witnessed last night at the community meeting with the change of leadership and so on. So first, I just want to say a little bit about the paper that I sent to the discussants, which is the case against public housing. So the case against public housing was waged by new residents to North Kenwood, Oakland, mostly black middle and upper income African Americans who moved in mid-1980s through today. And they waged the case against public housing in North Kenwood, Oakland, around the initial Gautreau ruling that public housing had been disproportionately cited in African-American neighborhoods. So for those of you all who aren't familiar with the Gautreau rulings, I just give you some snippets of the early orders, and I'll read maybe just the first one. Therefore, given the trend of Negro population movement, 99.5% of CHA family units are located in areas which are or soon will be substantially all Negro. It is incredible that this dismal prospect of an all Negro public housing system in all Negro areas came about without the persistent application of a deliberate policy to confine public housing to all Negro or immediately adjacent changing areas. And then the second is the judgment order that basically said that the Chicago Housing Authority had unconstitutional site selection and were barred from building public housing in all Negro areas. So then let me just ask, is there a timekeeper or a clock, or you are the timekeepers? Okay, great, thank you. So then the last order is really a pivotal moment in the history of the Gautreau case, and it's the revitalizing area order. And I'll read this one. In addition, recognizing that the total relief to Gautreau families outside of the limited areas are the predominantly black areas where the CHA was unallowed to build. So recognizing that total relief to Gautreau families outside of the limited area could not be provided in the foreseeable future, could not be provided, or the CHA was refusing to provide, the proposed decree introduces the concept of revitalizing areas. Areas which have substantial minority population and are undergoing sufficient redevelopment to justify the assumption that these areas will become more integrated in a relatively short time. So the revitalizing area began the move of the Gautreau case from race-based considerations to including class-based considerations. And so the revitalizing area order allowed public housing to be built where it's being built today, including in a lot of majority African-American neighborhoods, with the hope and the optimism that these neighborhoods would become racially integrated over time, and the knowledge that at least in the short term, they would be income integrated. So again, a move of the argument from race to class. The residents of North Kenwood, Oakland, the newcomer, middle-income and upper-income residents of North Kenwood, Oakland, strongly protested this move and protested the ability to build new public housing, replacement public housing for the lakefront properties in North Kenwood, Oakland. And they were able to file amicus briefs in the Gautreaux suit, and I'll just read you a couple of quotes from their, from some of the affidavits that were filed. So for example, they made a number of claims. They made a claim that North Kenwood, Oakland already had its fair share of affordable and public housing, that putting replacement or additional public housing in North Kenwood, Oakland created particular kinds of racial harm, given that the neighborhood was already predominantly black, and that third, replacing or putting new public housing in the neighborhood would stall any revitalization that was currently underway. So, for example, the lawyer for the Gautreaux, what was called the Residence for Responsible Redevelopment, or RRR, claimed the following: instead of these parties offering a remedy for past federal violations and discriminatory practices to the North Kenwood Oakland community, the community must now prove its burden. So instead of the case protecting black neighborhoods, which had been neighborhoods that CHA could not build in, now the community residents were having to mount their case to show that the neighborhood already was disproportionately burdened with public housing. The lawyer went on to say, if they, meaning the Chicago Housing Authority, if they can get waivers on top of waiver, they will nullify Gautreaux. Gautreaux means nothing. He said in another part of his amicus brief, now they talk about the parade of homes. The parade of homes was the first new market rate development in the neighborhood. They talk about the parade of homes, but we're saying how can 40 or 50 homes offset 241 public housing units? And if the people find out that these things are going up, they're not going to come in here, meaning market rate buyers. They're not even going to buy those parade of homes. And we're going to be stuck in the same mud that we've been stuck in since the Emancipation Proclamation. And we are asking you, Your Honor, to not grant them their motion to go forward. So you see here in the in his evoking of the Emancipation Proclamation, their particular emphasis on the racial harm in the proposal to build new public housing in North Kenwood, Oakland. So this is the case against public housing in North Kenwood, Oakland, which I guess one could say won and failed simultaneously. The public housing was not replaced one for one, but there was also replacement public housing put in the neighborhood. And I just want to read the final order from the judge in the case, who said the following. So what we have here is a unique situation. A plaintiff, the federal authorities, the local authorities, the receiver, and the people in the community, for the most part, working together to do what they can to implement the 1969 Gautreaux decree. It is not surprising, and I would be shocked if it were otherwise, that people generally do not want scattered site housing in their communities, and with good motives on their part. And as I say, significantly, people complain in African American communities that, look, we have got enough public housing in our area, put it elsewhere. Just so you know, this is not the official order. This was his talking in the court. His language was not this informal in the official order. You try to put a handful of units in a predominantly white area, and the people in that community claim that they can't even handle a handful of units. The reality is that public assisted housing is not popular in any area with the people in that area. The bottom line is, though, that this is not a decision for me to make. I've said on many times that I don't sit as the housing czar for the city of Chicago. It's a job that I don't want. It's not a part of my job title. It's not part of my obligations in the Gautreaux case, and it's a job that I wouldn't accept in any event. I'm not competent to handle the job. I don't delude myself that I am. From time to time, lawyers come before me. The plaintiff comes before me, or one of the parties in the lawsuit with a motion. Sometimes, like the motion today, it's a motion that's agreed upon. Sometimes it's not agreed upon. Sometimes it's a motion with which the consent decree requires them to make an order for me to implement a part of the consent decree. Sometimes it's a motion to vary some specific restrictions in the consent decree in order to go along with the broad-based philosophy and spirit of the consent decree. And I rule on those motions, and I rule on them as a matter of law. So I give this lengthy quote to illustrate the way in which the revitalizing order, the 1981 order, was such a pivotal moment in the way in which it allowed the judge to now rule on the revitalizing nature of North Kenwood Oakland. And what the residents of North Kenwood Oakland argued allowed for the memory of the race-based case for Gautreaux to be erased and to disappear. And his abdication of being the housing czar is part, and ruling only on motions, allows for this collective amnesia around the initial Gautreaux case. So the second part of the talk today that I want to give today is the case for public housing in North Kenwood, Oakland. And I do this schizophrenia really to illustrate the complexity of the discussions around race, poverty, class, and public housing in cities, given the need to provide affordable housing, but also the realities of racial segregation and class-based segregation in the city. So I want to talk about the case for public housing, in particular to illustrate that case by talking about the fate of various promises made to public housing residents when they were moved out of the lakefront properties in 1986. So in February of 1985, the Chicago Housing Authority submitted an application to HUD for funds to redevelop all of its public housing, or renovate all of its public housing, and they were granted $750 million $14 million for the lakefront properties. All of their requests weren't granted, but $14 million specifically to renovate the lakefront properties. HUD granted those requests in September of 1985, and this story hit the newspapers before the CHA told the residents. And the residents woke up to captions in the newspaper that said, CHA work to empty 6 buildings. And this was the notification to residents. While most residents agreed that the buildings were in bad physical shape, they were not pleased with the surprise announcement that they would be moved to other CHA developments, most of which they perceived to be more dangerous. More importantly, from this very first announcement of renovation, there was considerable suspicion that the new lakefront housing would not include them. For example, here's a quote from a newspaper article during the time. One person said, once they relocate us and renovate the buildings, they'll raise the rents and we won't be able to afford to move back in. So I begin in the book, I begin this chapter with the old quip, sure I'm paranoid, but the question is, am I paranoid enough? And so public housing residents in the neighborhood were often accused of being paranoid, that they thought that they wouldn't be able to move back in, and they thought that the city would sell the land, and they thought, and people would constantly reassure them and say that they were being paranoid. But this is an illustration kind of where paranoia first sets in. Residents were also worried about how long the renovation would take, if they would have first priority to move back in, and if they could have their same apartment. And to all of these questions, the CHA responded in all the right ways. Residents raised their voices and demanded inclusion in the planning for the rehabilitation, and they organized themselves in the Lakefront Community Organization. When residents protested that they didn't want to move during the renovation of the buildings, the CHA chairman responded, quote, the Board of Commissioners has heard the voices of angry tenants. It is our decision today to put to rest the notion that the residents will have to move. It's a dead issue. So this was the first promise. There would be no relocation during the renovation. In fact, instead, families would be moved to different apartments as the renovation proceeded. But despite this public assertion, moving the lakefront properties residents out of their apartments was hardly a dead issue. And in fact, after a task force was convened, after the chairman of the CHA said, it's a dead issue, a task force was convened to kind of understand the feasibility of how the buildings would be renovated, and they said that people had to be moved. So the first promise was that people wouldn't have to be moved, and soon after, not only were some people moved, but everyone was moved. So all six buildings were completely emptied. Concurrent with the task force, the Lakefront Community Organization was also negotiating an agreement with the Chicago Housing Authority to govern the relocation and rehabilitation process. On May 27, 1986, the LCO and the presidents of each building and the CHA and all of the respective lawyers signed an agreement entitled a Memorandum of Accord. It had a very long title, but I'll just call it the Memorandum of Accord. In the memorandum, the LCO agreed to this relocation. They set out priority criteria for the residents to return to rehab units. They demanded more security during the rehabilitation, and they demanded the official right to return as tenants in the lakefront properties after the rehabilitation was complete. So, sanctioned by both the memorandum and the task force recommendation, relocation began in earnest in 1986. All of the buildings were emptied except for one, which was occupied by about 30 tenant leaders who were determined to monitor and enforce the memorandum of accord on site. Is that really true? Okay, so I'm going to have to shorten this story. It has a whole bunch of good, interesting tidbits, so you'll have to read it more fully. And basically, let me go through these points. So after the promise was made not to relocate families, all families were moved out. Promises were made by people at every level, from the aldermen to the Chicago Housing Authority to HUD, that the buildings would not be demolished. And in 1998, all of the buildings were demolished. Promises were made that construction of all the replacement units would begin before demolition, but ultimately demolition proceeded with what the court said was substantial but not full construction of the replacement units. Promises were made not to sell the land to private interests, but much of the land now, because the developers decided it would be very difficult to sell condos and houses if people couldn't own the land under them. So full private management and partial private ownership on the site. So the CHA still maintains some ownership. And the promises were made for right of return. And this is a sticky one, because part of the issue, as I mentioned, is this story proceeds over, 2009, and they were moved out in 1986, so however many, 25 years that is. And many of the families have moved on and are happy where they are. But the additional thing is that much of the mixed income housing has a lot of pretty stringent site-specific criteria that curtails the if some families were to come back, the kinds of bars that they have to reach in order to move back. So these politics of promises, let me just conclude, makes the case for public housing in North Kenwood, Oakland. So a series of successive promises were made, most of which were not kept. This is the second or the third point, So let me go through these points, my conclusions. So first of all, this is the case against public housing, that we need to figure out a way, and I look forward to Mr. Polakoff's comments on this, to reconcile fair housing and affordable public housing policy. So the fair housing side is the fact that Gautreau said you couldn't build in black neighborhoods, and of course we are building in black neighborhoods, but the affordable public housing side is we have a need to build replacement public housing for people who were promised replacement public housing. The second thing is reconciling policies, law, and public housing resident positions and preferences. So many of the public housing residents, there were times in the Gautreau case where public housing residents in North Kenwood, Oakland were on the opposite side arguing from the Gautreau lawyers who were representing public housing residents. Third, I go through a series of changes in leadership, which of course we all know. The CHA had, I think, seven directors from the time that the lakefront properties were first emptied to the time that they were demolished. So this turnover weakens institutional accountability. I heard this several times last night at my community meeting where residents would say, well, this was promised to the neighborhood, and the CHA representative would say, well, I wasn't in this position when that was promised, so I'm not sure about that. And that not sure about that might suggest you might have your history wrong. It's a little you know, there's a game being played when people are not the people who were the ones who made the promises. And then finally, obviously, that these failed promises undermine trust in institutions, and it's something that we see in working with public housing residents who are now continuously asked to trust the CHA with the mixed income communities, with the relocation, with the redevelopments. So I'll stop there. I look forward to the discussion and to your questions.
Good morning. Can everyone hear me? This reminds me a little bit of the last time I sang the national anthem at Soldier Field. So I'm Jens Ludwig. I'm going to talk about moving to opportunity in Chicago. The place that I wanted to start goes back to the Housing Act of 1937, signed by President Roosevelt. Section 8 of the Housing Act says that housing policy in the United States is intended not just to improve housing conditions for low-income families, but also to promote, quote, economically mixed housing. In practice, what we've seen historically in the United States is a variety of housing policies, maybe most obviously public housing, contributing to the concentration of poor families in very high poverty neighborhoods. Over the past several decades, we've started to see some change in housing policy towards poverty deconcentration. This includes, at the federal level, a growing share of spending on housing subsidies for poor families now comes in the form of housing vouchers rather than public housing, which gives poor families, at least in principle, more of a choice over the type of neighborhood in which they live. As you all know, we've seen HUD fund the HOPE 6 program that's provided CHA and other housing authorities across the country with resources to demolish some of the highest poverty public housing complexes around the country. And we've also seen a movement towards mixed income housing developments, which often either explicitly or at least implicitly wind up subsidizing non-poor families to live near poor families. Now, the policy question that I want to spend my time talking about is what we know or what we think we know about the degree to which neighborhood socioeconomic or sociodemographic composition affects the life chances and well-being of poor families, that includes parents and children. And I've been working for the past 15 years on evaluating a HUD-funded randomized experiment known as Moving to Opportunity. That I want to focus my comments on, but I first wanted to start a little bit, I think sort of following Mary's lead, thinking a little bit about the historical backdrop for what I'm going to talk about. Those of you who've read Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, you know at the turn of the last century, housing conditions for so many poor families were absolutely dreadful. This is a picture of housing tenements on the south side of Chicago in the 1940s. Here's another view of that. This was the backdrop for the decision in the 1950s and 1960s in many American cities, including here in Chicago, to develop a system of government subsidized and operated public housing projects. Does anyone know who the slightly dour-looking gentleman in the middle of this slide is? This is Senior Mayor Daley, right? When you look at this picture, I think it's fair to say that the public housing units that you see in this model don't seem so bad. This is actually what we got in practice. So this is a picture of the Robert Taylor homes on the south side. This is a different view. It looks not so dissimilar in architecture and architectural style and feel from a supermax prison. And this is what it looks like on the inside. So I assume most of the people in this room have at some point actually been inside the Robert Taylor homes. This gives you a feel for what it's like. I think one of the most salient aspects of the physical environment in the Robert Taylor homes for me is the floor-to-ceiling fence in the open-air corridors, which really, it's hard not to get away from the feeling of it being a prison. The other thing that I want to see, so this picture for me is particularly heartbreaking because I have a 5-year-old daughter, and when I see the kids on the tricycle here in the hallway, it's very moving for me personally. The other thing about this picture that I think is worth noting for what I'm about to talk to you next is that it is no accident that the children in this Robert Taylor Holmes hallway are African American. So if you looked at the public housing, the distribution of families historically in public housing, what you would have seen is that African-American families receiving housing assistance were disproportionately likely to be located in public housing in the highest, high-concentrated poverty neighborhoods in Chicago. This led to the Gautreaux lawsuit that Mary mentioned, I think everyone in this room is familiar with, maybe particularly Mr. Polakoff. I'm sure he'll talk about this during his remarks. This was a lawsuit filed against the Chicago Housing Authority and HUD and resulted in a ruling of racial discrimination and led to the dispersal of African-American public housing families to either the suburbs of Chicago or to other parts of the city. Now, I'm sure most of the people in this room are familiar with the work of sociologist James Rosenbaum from Northwestern, who had the brilliant idea to follow the outcomes of Gautreaux families as they were dispersed to the suburbs versus other parts of the city. And what we saw in Jim's work was the Gautreaux families who relocated from public housing to the suburbs wound up having markedly improved life outcomes compared to families who moved to other parts of the city of Chicago. And in particular, the children who wound up moving to the suburbs rather than other parts of the city had dramatically improved schooling outcomes. We also saw parents having substantially improved labor market outcomes. Now, these results understandably commanded a huge amount of public attention when they were released. They have first-order important scientific implications, but also implications for housing policy. One of the things that people have been worried about in the decades since the Gautreaux housing research has been released is the question of whether the differences in outcomes between city and suburban movers really are due entirely to the difference in the neighborhood environments that families experienced, as opposed to other systematic differences in the characteristics of families who wound up moving into the suburbs versus wound up moving to other parts of the city. And at least my reading of the research literature suggests that at least in recent years there's been some growing reason to worry that at least part of the dramatic difference in outcomes between city and suburban movers could potentially be due to some systematic difference in the types of families who move into different types of places. Nevertheless, the Gautreaux findings were dramatic enough to motivate the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development to sponsor a formal randomized experiment, that is, this would be like a clinical, the housing policy analog to a clinical trial in medicine, to definitively try and answer the question of whether moving families out of highly distressed public housing projects into more socioeconomically, at least, mixed neighborhoods really did have the profound impacts on children and parents' outcomes that the Gautreaux findings had suggested. So this HUD experiment is Moving to Opportunity, or MTO. This began in 1994. It enrolled a total of 4,600 families over the period from 1994 to 1998. It's been in operation in 5 cities. Chicago is one of the sites. The others are Baltimore, Boston, Los Angeles, and New York. To be eligible for the Moving to Opportunity program, families had to contain children. They had to be living in public housing located within the highest poverty census tracts of these 5 cities. So in Chicago, these were the Robert Taylor projects on the south side from which families were drawn. Now, the way that the Moving Opportunity Program worked is we had 4,600 income-eligible families from very distressed public housing units apply. The first, and then families were randomly assigned into 3 groups that experienced very different types of housing assistance to either basically stay where they are or move into much more socioeconomically mixed neighborhoods as a way to rigorously understand what the effects of these types of dramatic neighborhood changes are on the life chances of families. So one possibility is that, so 4,600 families signed up, 1,800 of these families were assigned into what we call the MTO experimental group. These families were offered housing vouchers to move to lower poverty neighborhoods. One of the conditions of the experimental group housing vouchers was that they could only be redeemed in low poverty neighborhoods, defined as census tracts with 1990 poverty rates below 10%. Families were also given housing search assistance by a local nonprofit to help them make these moves. And what we saw is that about half of the families who were randomly assigned into the MTO experimental group wound up successfully moving with a housing voucher. And we can talk more during the Q&A session about why the voucher utilization rate is not higher than 47%. The second possibility is another 1,350 families were assigned into what we call the regular Section 8 group. These families were offered housing vouchers without any MTO program constraints on the types of neighborhoods in which they can be used. A higher proportion of these families, 68%, wound up moving with a voucher. These families wound up making less pronounced changes in the types of neighborhoods into which they moved relative to the movers within the MTO experimental group. And then finally, 1,400 families in MTO were assigned into control group. These families didn't lose access to any of the social services that they were receiving prior to joining MTO, but they didn't get any special housing assistance as part of the MTO program. Okay. excuse me. Before I tell you a little bit more about what MTO, the impact of the MTO program on the families who signed up, let me tell you just a little bit about the families who signed up for the MTO program. This, if you think about where these families were drawn from, these families were drawn from some of the from the most distressed public housing projects in the United States. It's not surprising that this program population is extremely disadvantaged itself. So, only about one in five households was employed at baseline. Almost all of these families were single-parent families. Remember, one of the eligibility criteria is that all of the households contain children. In the Baltimore and Chicago MTO demonstration sites, the program populations are almost entirely African-American. In the other three demonstration sites, the program populations are about evenly mixed between African-American and Latino families. And let me show you a little bit, for starters, let me try and tell you a little bit more about what MTO does in terms of changing the neighborhood environments of the families that sign up. I'm going to focus on the contrast between the families who are assigned into the experimental group, they're offered housing vouchers that can only be redeemed in low poverty neighborhoods, the contrast between that experimental group of families and the control group, because that is the most pronounced contrast in neighborhood environments that we see in MTO, and therefore I think is of the greatest interest. So the first set of the yellow bars that I'm going to show you will be the average neighborhood characteristics of families assigned into the control group, and then the orangish-red bars will be the average neighborhood characteristics of all the families assigned into the experimental group, whether they actually move with a voucher or not. So these are the average characteristics of the families assigned into the control group. You can see that these are measured about 5 years after random assignment. The average control group family is living, for instance, in a census tract with an average poverty rate of about 45%. So this is a very disadvantaged neighborhood environment that families are experiencing. Almost all of the families are living in tracts with poverty rates above 30%. These are extremely dangerous neighborhoods, consistent with the idea that far and away the most important reason families signed up for MTO was safety. You can see that the victim of crime bar in particular, I think, is quite dramatic. These are the responses to the follow-up survey question, was anyone in your home the victim of a crime during the last 6 months? During the last 6 months, okay, this is a six-month household crime victimization rate. About one in five of the households had someone victimized during the last 6 months. This is an amazingly high crime victimization rate. Now, these are the average neighborhood characteristics that we see among all the families assigned into the experimental group, whether they move or not. What you can see is that the average census tract poverty rate is dramatically lower for the families who are assigned into the experimental group. The change in neighborhood poverty rates is even more pronounced if you focus just on the experimental families who actually move with a voucher into the low poverty neighborhoods. I think one of the other really striking contrasts in this chart is the crime victimization impacts. You can see 21% of the control group families had had someone in the home victimized over the last 6 months. That's about 40% lower, about 13% of the experimental group families had had someone victimized. And again, that reduction in criminal victimization is even more dramatic if you look at the experimental families who actually move. Now, the next question to think about from a social science and a housing policy perspective and a community development perspective is what are the impacts of these quite pronounced, almost dramatic changes in neighborhood environments on the behavior and well-being of the families who sign up for the MTO program? And I think the answer is, it is fair to say, surprising, or at least surprising to me and most of the people who have been working on the MTO program. Now, one place to start, if I was more technologically savvy and organized, what I would have done is, and what I should have done, is shown you a picture of the Chicago families and where they actually wind up going. So most of these families are in the around the Robert Taylor homes on the south side. The families assigned into the Section 8 group, they move into less distressed areas, but they're, this is a, my hand motions are a very poor substitute for a real picture, but if you can imagine, the families in the Section 8 group are clustered around the baseline housing projects. They're moving to lower poverty areas, but they're clustered around. Not surprising if you think about the lack of transportation and the social ties that families have. And then the experimental group families, these are the families who get vouchers, they have to move to low poverty areas, they're dispersed even more in a crescent around the Section 8 families. So these families are being pushed more and more away from the baseline housing projects and more towards the suburban areas where many people have noted a lot of the low-skilled job opportunities are increasingly being located, right? So if you think about distance to job as being one of the key employment barriers to families in high-poverty urban neighborhoods, you would have thought that MTO should have really big impacts on employment rates for these women. And what you see, again, the yellow bar is the mean for the control group and the red, orangish-red bar is for the experimental group families. There was no impact 5 years after random assignment on labor market outcomes for any of the families who were assigned into the experimental group, which is really quite a surprise when you think about the geographic change and the neighborhood composition change that these families experience. I will admit that this is probably the least effective slide of all time in highlighting exactly how dramatic the impact on mental health of families were in this case. Right, so the next set of bars here is an indicator of mental distress. So a higher score indicates worse mental health. The way that I have very inartfully created the graph, that looks like a trivially small but statistically significant difference in improved mental health for the experimental families. To give you some sense for the magnitude of this is about the same magnitude change in mental health as what you would get from best practice Prozac treatment for depressed moms. This is a massive change in mental health, improvement in mental health for families who move, consistent with the idea that they're moving to dramatically safer neighborhood environments. We saw no change in self-reported physical health status 5 years out of after random assignment, but statistically significant declines in obesity. Now, this is what we saw for achievement test outcomes for children 5 years after random assignment. These are math and reading scores for males and females. The scaling of this chart is a little bit different. These are standard deviation effect sizes, and basically no change in achievement test scores for children, which came as a big, this is measured 5 years after random assignment, and this comes as something of a big surprise given the large changes in neighborhood environments that these families are experiencing. Now, the story for non-academic achievement outcomes for children is a little bit more complicated. This is for female youth and the families, and we're looking at indicators of mental distress, marijuana use, behavior problems, this is like shoplifting, getting in fights, and then the number of lifetime property crime arrests. These are all bad outcomes, so the higher the bar, the more antisocial the average outcomes are for the kids. And you can see that for female youth, their behavior changes on every one of these outcome measures in the way that lots of sociological theory and your intuition would have predicted in advance. So far, so good. If we look at male teens, so remember, the higher the bar, the more antisocial the behavioral outcome. If we look at the male teens in these families, you don't see that pattern quite so much, I think it's fair to say. And in fact, along most of the behavioral outcomes that we look at for the five-year MTO evaluation, the male youth who move do much worse. Now, we can talk more about why this is during the question and answer session. Once you see this profound gender difference in MTO impacts, you can immediately begin to develop a lot of after-the-fact hypotheses and explanations for why that might be. But I think it's very fair to say that prior to seeing these five-year MTO results, nobody expected to see this type of profound gender difference in how youth would respond to the MTO mobility intervention. So what are the lessons from the moving to opportunity experiment? At least for me personally, this winds up making me feel much more confused and uncertain about how housing policy should think about allocating scarce resources to housing policy interventions that explicitly are focused on trying to change the socioeconomic composition of neighborhoods, as opposed to directly trying to provide services to low-income families that they might leave. So, for instance, if you think about things like mixed-income developments as part of a community development strategy, a mixed-income development intervention diverts resources from poor families directly to non-poor families in order to change the socioeconomic composition of the neighborhood. I think it's fair to say, at least for me from the MTO results, I wind up wondering whether that itself is necessarily the greatest value-added use of scarce housing assistance dollars. Now, since I am an optimist at heart, let me close on a more optimistic point, which is to say, it is also the case, if you reflect on MTO even briefly, you can imagine for a long list of reasons why any beneficial effects of moving into a low poverty area could accumulate and grow over time. For instance, if families become increasingly socially integrated into their lower poverty neighborhoods. I'm the project director for the long-term 10-year evaluation of moving to opportunity. In principle, it's possible that this surprising gender difference in MTO impacts on youth might change over the 10-year period relative to the 5-year evaluation, and it's possible that MTO might have much more beneficial impacts on a much broader range of family outcomes over the 10-year period compared to the 5-year period. Right now, this falls into the category of an open empirical question, and I look forward to coming back for the 105th anniversary of SSA and telling you more about what we've learned. Thank you very much.
Thank you. While I don't include an acknowledgement slide, you should know that the MacArthur Foundation supports this research into the New Communities Program with Craig Howard, who just left the room, playing an integral role, first as the project director for the initiative and later as our funder. This presentation, I think, is an interesting contrast to some of the others on the panel, and I think Rob was conscious of this in setting up not only the mix of presentations, but also this title. And it draws on observations from implementation research within the New Communities Program, or NCP. And coming from New York, from MDRC, such research is impossible without the partnership of a lot of local organizations. Rob at Chapin Hall, Garth Taylor from MCIC, but especially the reflections of community-based practitioners whose openness to learning really forms our ability to try to drill down into practice and understand what it really takes in order to implement community change, place-based initiatives in the context that we discussed earlier today. So, the New Communities Program is a place-based initiative. Professor Ludwig's discussion earlier raised questions about what how to divert resources between people-based and place-based strategies. It's a very much a place-based initiative that is funded by the MacArthur Foundation and managed by Chicago LISC. And what it does is it funds 14 neighborhood organizations in 16 or more Chicago neighborhoods to conduct community planning exercises. And these planning exercises bring together local organizations to identify projects of significance to improve quality of life in varied areas, not only involving traditional areas of community improvement for CDCs like housing investments, but also social services, education, and the arts. And in doing so, it intertwines two strands of place-based work that Rob talked about earlier in his presentation: community development models and comprehensive community initiatives. Community development models, as was discussed earlier and many of you are familiar with, a form of urban intervention starting in the 1960s, really to take a place-based strategy about promoting neighborhood revitalization. And CDCs do diverse work, but they become increasingly known with the production of affordable housing. The second form that it draws from is the tradition of comprehensive community initiatives, which, as Rob described, a form of intervention sort of stemming from the late 1980s that was an attempt either to bring together and integrate multiple systems to attack a single problem or to work within place to target multiple but interrelated urban problems. But the New Communities Program also is an attempt to respond to some limitations of both of these strands of work. So it's an attempt to sort of learn from what we have experienced over the past decades around place-based and community initiatives. These include the challenges of comprehensiveness. So NCP is a comprehensive community development effort, and it explicitly encourages CDCs, or community development corporations, to work in areas beyond a bricks and mortar focus and expand into other interconnected realms of urban challenges. So, as I discussed earlier, the planning processes that NCP supports around Chicago identify not only opportunities for housing and commercial real estate investment, but also workforce development, social services, youth development, and beautification efforts. It also addresses challenges of relationships. So, as Rob alluded to earlier, one critique of community development corporations is that they are sometimes possessed of a go-it-alone mode of practice, where there's not always the formation of broader coalitions in an effort to change communities. NCP, in contrast, suffuses its very model with a capacity-building focus. So the effort is both to try to connect organizations to each other through the planning process and also to make sure that these relationships are maintained during implementation. And I should note that even though comprehensive community initiatives, of which NCP is a model, sometimes work through relationships, issues of mistrust within CCIs are often seen to be a very significant component of hampering their implementation. So relationships is very important to NCP. The third challenge that NCP tries to address are ones around implementation. Comprehensive community initiatives are sometimes seen to struggle in the transition of moving from planning and sort of the formation of community plans into a period where projects are able to get done as a result of those plans. And NCP takes a very conscious approach to try to make sure that plans are translated into reality. And it does this in a way that we've seen tries to balance authority, accountability, and coordination by designating a single community organization, or also known as a lead agency, to coordinate the planning efforts, but in a significant shift from what was its pilot initiative, doesn't require that this agency alone implement the projects. So there are other CCIs that have a single organization both do the planning and also implement what was in the plans. And in contrast, contrast, the strategy within NCP is to have the lead agency really identify multiple hands within the community that can do the work. So that's a strategy around implementation. And the last has to do with challenges of scale, an issue within community interventions broadly that has been discussed earlier today. And that's how to make investments that are meaningful and that can draw down new resources to try to change community trajectories. And the way that NCP works around this concept is to make sure that these seed grants, which are promoted, or passed through from MacArthur to LISC, try to attract leverage. That is, they're connected to, these projects are tried to connect to public or private resources so that they don't represent the grants alone, but are suffused with broader investments. These are the neighborhoods in which NCP works in Chicago. As you see, it's a diverse set of neighborhoods, something that poses an advantage for our research, as the neighborhoods include not only neighborhoods with that have experienced patterns of historic disinvestment, such as Englewood and Woodlawn, but also growing immigrant communities such as Chicago Lawn, Little Village, and neighborhoods that are experiencing gentrification pressure such as Logan Square and in some parts of Humboldt Park. So I'm going to talk briefly about some observations from our research just to reflect on some practitioner challenges or dilemmas of practice that stem from the contextual issues discussed today. I'm going to talk about intermediaries and their roles. Intermediaries are a central part of the NCP model. About building relationships through NCP, the types of projects that were implemented, and also insights about strategy and context. And while the research also tries to understand neighborhood trajectories and good and bad economic times, that's something that I'm not going to talk about today. So intermediaries and their role. So intermediaries are a central part of the NCP model. Intermediaries being organizations that try to support relationships among community groups and also build their capacity, and while doing that, sort of direct resources to them. LISC, Local Initiative Support Corporation, is in itself a community development finance intermediary and plays a critical role as the managing intermediary for this initiative. And LISC's role was very critical. It both managed the initiative, it enforced accountability among partners, and played a critical role in developing technical assistance to support local intermediaries, and was generally viewed very positively by participants. One issue that I think is worth noting, I talked a little bit before about the structure of NCP being a way of passing through these small seed grants to local partners. Something that we've observed that relates to the structure of the initiative, not necessarily LISC's role in managing these grants, is that these seed grants are seen by some community partners as small and not always sustainable. So a quote from one practitioner, which brings some of these complaints to light: "The seed money, in my view, is not enough. Because when they're talking about seed money, they're talking about $25,000 to $30,000 for a youth program. I mean, that's nothing. You can't even hire a coordinator for that amount." And while in a couple of slides I'll talk about ways in which these seed grants actually did result in attracting some major resources to communities on occasion, they didn't always do that. And it's something to think about in terms of the structure of the initiative as a whole, not necessarily its management. Another key intermediary role within NCP is what I described earlier as the planning role that community groups take on at the beginning of the initiatives. They need to bring local organizations together to try to vision for the future and create this quality of life plan. And we found that participants felt that lead agencies led successful planning processes generally, although with some variations that I'll discuss in a little bit, fulfilling a very important part of that intermediary role. So the second part of the roles of intermediaries in an initiative like NCP is making sure that once plans are identified, they become the plans are not just documents on paper, but move into implementation. And we noted that during implementation, lead agencies faced two types of challenges in making these plans a reality while keeping community groups engaged. We call these sort of catalyzing strategies and also sustaining strategies. Catalyzing strategies tie to finding the right partner to make sure that implementation moves forward, and also using political leverage to jumpstart plans. And sustaining strategies involving effective governance arrangements and good communication within the initiative. Lead agencies also faced choices about how to approach implementation. They took different routes to ensure that implementation was achieved. So recall that the intermediary strategy tries to identify a single community organization, but not have that single organization take charge of all the projects that are identified in plans. Now, the advantage of that is seen as not every organization has the capacity to do everything, and so it's a way of addressing that, but it also raises other issues about authority and accountability. A lead agency may have the resources to direct seed grants to incentivize action by others, but doesn't control the other organizations whose very work is necessary to making sure the plans are completed. So groups took different strategies to see that this type of implementation did occur. Some of them worked as brokering organizations, primarily directing seed grants to other groups. Some of them attempted to form collaborations among community organizations in an attempt to build their capacity and also attract additional funding. And some of them took on projects themselves. In the report that's forthcoming, we call these strategies brokering strategies, coordinating strategies, and doing strategies. So I'll turn to the issue of relationships formed through NCP. Recall that the community capacity building focus of NCP is something that tries to distinguish it from other types of community development models. And also just, in reference to some of the earlier panel discussion, in reality, although relationships can be promoted through community planning, interests diverge within communities. And Professor Patillo's discussion is a very good case study of how even when there can be shared goals of promoting affordable housing and perhaps creating mixed income communities, the terms and mechanisms around which that happened can be very divisive and very controversial. And one thing that NCP tries to do is to try to create a common vision by which these very contentious issues can find some common ground. So in many communities, partners with no prior working relationships were connected for the first time through NCP planning and implementation processes. These interviews provided some substantial evidence of enhanced relationships developing as a result of NCP. These enhanced relationships occurred primarily in neighborhoods where there were previous ties, so in neighborhoods where there were somewhat advanced organizational networks. But they also occurred in neighborhoods where there were contentious relationships before. As in the following case, in some historically disinvested neighborhoods, NCP helped improve relationships from difficult starting points. And this, I think, is a particularly significant finding. One of the challenges of doing CCI work and CDC work is that it occurs in neighborhoods where parties have a lot of reason to mistrust the form of community intervention that's being practiced. There are often suspicions of planning processes and also the roles of major institutional actors. In some cases, the University of Chicago, as Woodlawn is one of the sites in which NCP operates. And I'll read a quote from somebody, a participant in Woodlawn, that sort of embodies improvements, although from a difficult starting point. As a younger person whose family was coming up in Woodlawn, I was very suspicious of the university's role coming into this partnership position. I have a lot more appreciation for that now than before. So I think this process has been a two-way street in terms of being in a relationship and understanding challenges, and maybe even a way for increased public accountability of what the university says it's going to do. We also note that, similar to many community initiatives, a lot of the relationships that formed were intra-community, as opposed to bridging relationships with outside actors, public officials, or broader market and regional forces. But when they did, these enhanced and deepened relationships were, in fact, associated with an improved ability to carry out projects of significance to the community. And especially important is that these relationships sometimes helped leverage additional resources in areas where CDCs have sometimes struggled to bring in leverage, such as education, social services, and health. So related to the challenge of implementation, one of the central ones for CCIs in general, there's evidence that NCP helped manage this transition within the initiative and also worked in comprehensive domains. So while counting has some of its issues, NCP supported projects in varied domains, nearly 200 in economic and workforce development, 150 in housing and commercial real estate development, 150 in public spaces, community images and the arts, and the most in social services and health, nearly 300 there. The least were around explicit efforts to influence public policy, something that, as alluded to in Professor Chaskin's talk, is sort of a factor within community initiatives that may be especially important in this time of diminished resources for leverage. In many domains, there is substantial leverage achieved, especially around housing and commercial real estate. Some of this just is because of the nature of housing and commercial real estate development, where an initial grant can attract significant construction loans and other types of resources. But it also occurred in some other areas as well. Seed grants that, for example, brought in tax counseling services to communities helped bring in new resources in terms of the EITC, counseling for small businesses helped leverage loans, and many other examples. So one thing that we want to note around leverage is that even though NCP was sometimes associated with substantial additional resources, many of these smaller grants didn't always attract leverage. In fact, more than half of them didn't. However, in many of these instances, a small number of grants attracted significant leverage. So while 58% haven't reported leverage, a quarter reported leverage of less than 50,000, 14% attracted less than a million, 4% of the grants actually represented the majority of the leverage that I reported on the previous slides, between $1 and $15 million. So as I alluded to earlier, one of the advantages for us about doing research within Chicago is that the neighborhoods that we studied were, in some cases, very different from each other. There are so many communities that were studied that we have an advantage on some traditional evaluations of community initiatives, which are often single case studies and can only sort of take a thematic approach rather than an explanatory approach. And while my time is running out, I'll talk a little bit about a first set of insights here, which is that, especially around challenges of implementation, and the challenges that intermediaries face in deciding how to delegate projects to their partners, whether or not to take on projects themselves, or to sort of coordinate these broader collaborators which might attract additional funding. Somewhat surprising finding for us was that lead agencies that really were employing multiple strategies at once tended to be at an advantage. Although the NCP model was about, in many ways, brokering smaller grants to partners, what we found was that these strategies, these three types of strategies, tend to complement each other, lending legitimacy and momentum in some cases. So, for example, in Humboldt Park, one of the places that we studied, seed grants were reported to enhance an existing community coalition that met but didn't have any resources attracted to it. But that, especially because partners tended to feel that these seed grants were small, It was the coordination of collaboratives that brought in new resources that was seen to be especially valuable. So those types of complementary strategies turned out to be very important. And in contrast, groups that relied on a single strategy, especially carrying out projects themselves, tend to be particularly challenged. In discussion, I might want to talk a little bit more about organizational dynamics in historically disinvested neighborhoods. Some of these touched on by Professor Patillo. But looking forward, I think that we want to think about in the next phase of our evaluation ways that a collaborative community building model functions in a very different economic period. Although previous observations have shown that previous discussions have shown that the sort of foundation for the current economic crisis was certainly laid within the expansion of the earlier part of the decade and its housing bubble. We're still in a very different environment with the foreclosure crisis, what it is now. So looking at how these relationships form and respond to the economic crisis, how they make a difference in helping neighborhood resilience, and also how to understand patterns of community change during the economic downturn. Thank you.